You're listening to a podcast from the RSA. You can find out more about RSA events and projects and how to get involved with the fellowship by visiting our website, thersa.org.
We're now moving on to session two of the day, called Atoms, Bits and Everything in Between. This session is looking at the digital age, the advent of the digital age, and the introduction of new technologies and what that effect is having on the nature of making. So I'm going to pass over to our very able chairperson now, and thank you for joining us. Our panel is very on the move. Kitty Knowles from online technology magazine, The Memo.
Welcome to today's session, Atoms, Bits and Everything in Between. My name's Kitty Knowles, and as Rowan mentioned, I'm a reporter at technology publication The Memo. Today we'll be talking about how new technologies and digital platforms are changing the way we make things. There are new peer-to-peer platforms that allow designers to sell straight to customers, saving time, money, and cutting waste. There's open source hardware, which means that now anyone, anywhere in the world, can download a digital blueprint and print out and construct their own products at home. There's the Internet of Things, of course, the tech that lets the objects in your home speak to each other. And there's new digital fabrication processes, including my personal favourite, 3D printing. Today, our panellists will be discussing everything from the very tiny to the very great. We have Philip Colligan, Chief Executive of mini computer company Raspberry Pi. We have Sylvain Promon, founder of the world's biggest 3D printing studio, iMaker, and founder of online platform MyMiniFactory.com, as well as Bethany Kobe of DIY Tech Kits, Technology Will Save Us, and Jesse Baker from data platform Provenance. To start off, could you each give a brief one-minute elevator pitch explaining who you are, what you do, and why it's important?
Okay, thanks for having me. So I'm Chief Executive of the Raspberry Pi Foundation. You might have heard of us. We are a foundation with a mission to put the power of digital making into the hands of people all over the world. And we do that through three ways. Firstly, we produce high-powered, low-cost computers. We broke new ground last week by doing this. We started giving them away free on the cover of a magazine. Our premium product, top of the range for high rollers, is a fully functional general-purpose computer that costs $35. And the organisation, which I only joined recently, actually, intended to sell 10,000, and we recently passed 7 million. So it's become quite popular. Not enough people know we're a charity, so all of our profits, such as they are invested in our charitable mission. And that's the other two things we do, which is we try to make digital creativity more relevant and accessible to a wider group of people. Tomorrow night, we will be sending Raspberry Pi computers onto the International Space Station as part of a program with British astronaut Tim Peake. And kids in UK primary and secondary schools have written experiments that will run in space. And we do that because space is cool, and we trick kids into learning about computers through the medium of space. The other thing we do is we don't only make it more relevant and accessible, we try to provide the tools and the training that means that people can learn how to do things, how to make things with computers. So we train teachers, we provide online tutorials and resources and so on. So that's us.
So I'm from I'm the co-founder and CEO of Technology Will Save Us. So we make DIY technology kits and digital tools for kids and families to learn how to become producers of technology, creators of technology. We design our kits around everyday themes like gardening, cycling, gaming, music, fashion. We do big research projects to really understand what young people are making already in school, what they like making, but most importantly, why they like making. And we use those as themes to then develop products around. So we have a really user-centered approach to how we develop products, which we think is really unique and special. And that's allowed us to create really engaging kits that range from electronic Play-Doh, where you're actually making your own Play-Doh that is conductive, learning about circuits, learning about how LEDs turn on, buzzers buzz, motors spin, all the way to things like our DIY gamer kit, where you actually make your own games console. Then you play two games it comes with, Pong and Snake, that were programmed by a 15-year-old that did a work placement with us. Then you learn step by step how to actually program and invent your own games on a console that you made yourself. And this was acquired by the Museum of Modern Art last year as part of its permanent collection, and also was just recently acquired by the Design Museum as well. So we really feel that, and I know this is a question we'll talk about, that you don't have to sacrifice design and accessibility and, quite frankly, desirability to really engage parents and families in this process. And one thing that we launched quite recently is a new product that we developed with the BBC, which is a little tech tool called the Microbit. So it's based, essentially it's the micro for this generation. And unlike the micro of the 80s, which was essentially a computer that taught a generation to be engineers, this is a tech tool that's about programming in the physical world. So it's about sensors and accelerometers, but using programming as a tool to create things.
Jessie?
Cool. Yeah, I'm Jessie. I'm from Provenance. Provenance exists to help product-making businesses be more transparent. Why? Because we think it's important to know more about where things are made. We also hope it can help people make more socially and environmentally responsible choices with the things they choose to buy. We do this on three levels, so business-level transparency, like does this company pay tax? If so, where? Product level, so supply chain mapping and helping gather information from the product's journey so far. And increasingly, we're doing a lot more work on item level transparency, so exactly what materials are in this object now and into the future.
And Silva?
So, yes, iMaker and My Mini Factory. I'll try to be quick on both. iMaker is the first and largest retailer for 3D printers for, you know, everyone, not for like large companies, but more for like the one that you can buy and have for your home or whatever. We've started that in 2012, quite early, and basically we are the one and only place where you can go out today and see printers in action and talk with experts about what they can do and possibly buy one if you so wish, and every single supply you might need and trainings and expertise and whatever. So that is iMaker. iMaker is physically in a store in London here in Clerkenwell and also in New York, in Manhattan, and online, of course. My Mini Factory is, I would say, a sister company of it, and it is a platform, an online platform for 3D designers to upload their work and share and create, you know, and build their audience and share their creativity with the crowd. And for 3D printer owners to go and download files for them to print.
Thank you. So to kick off today's session, let's start by asking our panelists about the most inspiring things they've seen made with new technology and what key developments made these things possible. Philip, would you like to start?
Yes, and I'm going to break your rules because I'm really struggling to pick out one. I think one of the things that inspires me most is the sense of community and movement that we see around our work and around the maker movement, and particularly digital making. So this Saturday, I will go to a thing called Pi Wars in Cambridge. And that's a whole day event, which is a Robot Wars competition, organised by local volunteers who run one of the Raspberry Jams, which is like one of their volunteer community activities. And what they do is they support young people to build robots that perform a number of tasks, endlessly creative in kind of how that's done. The two guys there, who I won't embarrass by naming them, but, you know, they take time off work to read through the kids' code so they can give them feedback so that when they come to the day, their robots perform better and they're able to score them. And so the thing that I'm most inspired by is just this huge community around digital making that's appeared, that's developed, and how generous it is in terms of supporting people to learn.
Obviously, without these kind of communities, innovation just wouldn't be possible. Mm-hmm. But perhaps you'd like to bring it back to a product or a physical item that you...
So mine's not physical.
Oh?
And mine's not new either, I'm sorry. But it's kind of similar. And it's something that actually terrifies me and excites me. I think YouTube has done an absolutely incredibly transformative role in helping us to move from a society of consumers to producers. Mm-hmm. I think it has given us a platform which has allowed us to have opinions, share content, and with that freedom comes great content and terrible content. With that becomes great opinions and terrible opinions. But it has really catalyzed our ability to share and to give those opinions, whether that be physical, whether that be how to do something. And I actually think it really does create community in the physical world as well. So I think that's just been and continues to be a really important shift.
Yeah, and to take this across perhaps to Sylvain, who's obviously heavily involved with 3D printing, where we're seeing fantastic things being produced. I wondered if we could move on to something to do with more of the ethics of making. We've obviously seen guns being 3D printed. How can we or should we keep making moral in the digital age?
I have personally not seen any of these guns recently, although there was a lot of hype around that 2 years ago or something. Mm. I'm more interested into the prosthetics that you can actually do with 3D printing, and that makes much more sense. And by the way, even though we maybe speak less about them, they are much more actually on the field and really actually used everywhere in the world. And I do believe that it's going to be like this more and more. So ethics is not about us. It's about people, and it will probably not be a problem.
And, of course, it's not all about physical tech. Computing and the internet are rapidly changing the state of making today. Perhaps we could start by asking the makers of mini computers, Philip and Bethany, and then also, Jesse, I'm sure you'd like to weigh in, as you're all about collecting online data and how that informs makers themselves.
Yeah, I mean, I think YouTube, the same thing, the digital tools that have enabled us to be able to share our skills, our passions, our powers, how we make, why we make, is just profoundly shifted the ability for not just the few, but the many to have access to those tools. We were talking about forums, the importance of community in digital spaces that help people to solve problems, find new ways to do things. Without that, there was only the ability for people to do things face-to-face. And this allows for deep, supportive, debating communities to exist that some of them have never met each other. And I think that's really, really powerful.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think the main point we see is the ability for information to pass between people very, very quickly with no cost barrier, right? Mm-hmm. So people's experience of learning computing in the 1980s was typing code out of a magazine. And that isn't the case anymore. And one of the things that we see, and we were talking about forums earlier, you know, if you post a question on our forum because you're struggling to get your computer set up, whether it's a Raspberry Pi or indeed a different single board computer, you'll get an answer incredibly quickly because there's a 24-hour-a-day online community who's there to help, and they're very supportive. I think the other thing as well, though, is just connected devices, right? So we're about physical computing. We believe that making things in the real world, in the physical world, is one of the best ways to learn about how computers work. And we should all, let's face it, know more about how computers work because our lives are mediated through these things as part of the agency point, which I think is covered in the report that you guys have published. But the connected device and the Internet of Things, I think, is just opened up huge potential. You see people doing all kinds of systems in their home, controlling different devices, taking sensor readings in all kinds of ways, and that's enabled by the Internet.
And what about your platform, Jesse?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I'm super in awe of the internet as a learning medium as well, but I guess at Provenance we're more interested in how we can start to quantify the stuff we're making and start to perhaps give it a second life, particularly with 3D printing. We're seeing lots of plastic, I think, which is a bit problematic. What we're doing is trying to track on an open platform exactly what materials are used to make different things, start to look at how we might make that more open, more accessible to more people, and therefore start to think a bit smarter about the afterlife and hopefully moving towards a more circular economy. But unless we start to track that information, it's going to be quite difficult to do.
I mean, it's interesting that you raise the fact that everything's being sort of been still very much in the being made of plastic phase when it comes to 3D printing. And I wondered if I could ask perhaps a bit more of a controversial question. We've been talking about these technologies in a largely positive way, but do technology like Raspberry Pi and 3D printing live up to the hype?
So far, so good. And I do believe it's going to be more and more. Think of it like we are at the very, very early beginning of something. I mean, it's asking for 3D printing to deliver today to the level that you can expect is just like asking for the internet to be delivering what you see today, but back in 98 or something. I mean, give it some time. It takes time to spread to the crowd, you know, to be faster, cheaper, etc. usually you look at 30 years for a technology between it's available, like possibly physically possible, to the moment where everyone's got one. So if you think back to 70-something for the computers, you know, being available like small computers, to the point where everyone had one, it has taken 30 years, roughly. And same for those phones. The technology was there by 80-something, but it took 30 years until now. We all have two of them, one in each pocket. So 3D printing is not different from that. The technology per se has been invented in the 70s, 80s, but just for the large companies. And now it has been made available, like downsized, a couple of years ago. So give it 30 years and you'll see them everywhere. But be patient.
So, I mean, not to be too negative, but to lead with perhaps another criticism, with the digitization of making and manufacturing, could it be said that we're eroding true craftsmanship? I know, Bethany, you had some thoughts on this.
We don't think so at all, because it just requires an expansion of how we define craft. In making, and I'm defining making really broadly, not just 3D printing, not just Raspberry Pis, but CNC machines, laser cutting, woodworking. There's a ton of definitions of how that kind of works. And speaking from our experience, there's a lot of craftsmanship that go into the tools that we create for the digitization to occur. So the design of the product, the interaction of it, the end-to-end experience, the user journey we create with our digital tools. I just think it's an evolution of how we're defining craft.
I would agree with Bethany. I think it is a new form of craft, but I think there are some big questions around it still, because it does, well, it removes the human quite often from the making process, perhaps not the design process or tooling, but from the making process. I guess it's a big thing that we're trying to do with Provenance, is trying to give people the choice as to how they want their things produced, so that things aren't just bought on their aesthetic value, but also on their production values as well.
You know, do they live up to the hype, right? So if part of the hype was, will the cost and accessibility of general purpose computing drop to a level where that ceases to be a barrier? Yeah, it's done, right? So $5 computers that you can watch movies, surf the internet on, I think we're kind of, that's as far as we're going to go for a long time. I think if the hype is, can we empower people to shape their world through digital technologies, we're at the foothills. So we've got a long, long way to go in terms of giving people the confidence that they can make things with digital technologies, not just consume. What we have done, I think, and I think we should be proud of the accomplishments, is we've made general purpose tools. And that's the start. You know, craftsmanship is about using tools and ingenuity to make things that solve problems. We've got the tools now.
In a world where objects are massively manufactured in massive companies and then sold to millions and billions of people, there is a long chain of number of people involved in tiny bit of the conception, the design and everything. No one is really doing more than just what they have to do, and it's a lot of different tasks, and in my view, human is kind of not present in there. When you go down to what we are doing, where you are no longer looking at millions or billions of objects sold, but more like, you know, 1,000 or even less, just because you are in a niche and someone thought about, I need that, he made that happen, and that is only useful for him and possibly 1,000 people worldwide. It's still going to be possible to get that working, get that distributed through the internet download print business. And so many more of more, possibly more simple things, but with much more human in there, like more human designing, more human creating, making, and more human using and involved in the things. So I see that as much more human and much more us, all of us, involved.
I think that's a great point. I think there's a real, there's an importance to create a distinction between platforms that are being created as tools for individuals to make with versus end products that are solving challenges or creating small runs of things that people might want to consume or have or share, or there's a real distinction between that, because I mean 7 million, that's a lot, and more hopefully, right? And We're not trying to create things that are going to be used by the few. We want to create learning tools that will empower mass markets to see this as something they can do. But that's different than small runs of products that someone might want to make and stay small. And so I think there's a real important distinction between kind of that those different kinds of outputs this space.
On this sort of future-gazing note, I wondered if in our final question with the panel, we could ask you all, what do you expect making and manufacturing to look like in the next 10 to 15 years? I mean, you say we've got the tools and that it's about making things more human, but how exactly could we go about doing that? Anyone?
I guess part of the answer was already given earlier, and that is that microbit tool that we just mentioned. So My Mini Factory is very proud to be one of the partners of that big BBC-supported operation where 1 million kids will receive that bit, is it January something? We are involved for the design of it. By the way, the casing needs to be, of course, specific to your usage, so you want to design that yourself. So we are busy designing the software that will help the kids do that. But the reason I mention is because 1 million kids learning about that thing at school today means that, 10 years from now, these kids, I mean, for them, it's not rocket science. It's not like future. It's present. I mean, we, all of us, like especially, I see a number of you have my age. So we have always looked into things like, I need that. I go someplace to buy it. If it's not available, just forget it. Probably I don't need it. And that will change. These kids, they need something, they get it, they make it, they have that. I mean, there is no point, they won't have something that they need. If it's just possible, they'll make it happen. Just because they change the mindset. They learn at school how to do things themselves, thanks to Microbit, thanks to us all, I would say.
And the future of online platforms?
Because I think if everyone makes whatever they want, like, we're screwed, basically. Especially if we carry on like we are. I don't know. I think the maker movement's amazing, and I think a lot of it is focused on local, small maker spaces now, but that doesn't mean it's going to continue. And it might just be that we're talking about more outsourced, globalised manufacture, but this time it's all done by robots thanks to this wonderful innovation happening in the maker movement. I really hope that doesn't happen, and I think these tools should help teach people to, be able to make whatever they want to make, but also to be able to make in a local way, socially and environmentally positive way. But I think we need to bake that into the making process right now.
Mm. And do you guys have anything to add on our future-gazing theme before we open questions to the floor?
I just think there's something about the kind of less homogenous world that we'll live in that is maybe a little messier and a little less hermetically sealed than this world that we exist in from a tech perspective, but might be a little more meaningful because people have the skills, the tools, the capacity to actually modify things, hack them, take them apart, put them back together, make hybrids.
Yeah.
I think that's a pretty exciting, not this future we're in right now.
So, if I learned one thing in my years at Nest, I was at Nest for 5 years, was don't make predictions about 10 to 15 years' time. So I'm not going to make any. What I will say is that, to this point about sustainability and so on, I think there's a real challenge for us now to help kids and adults understand the world in which they're inhabiting, right? It's mediated through digital technologies on a scale that nobody 15 years ago possibly imagined. Possibly a few science fiction authors, right? But generally, we're all existing in a world where we don't really understand how things are being done to us. And I think part of our passion in the Raspberry Pi Foundation is that one of the reasons you want people to have a go with digital making and understand it is because it gives them a sense of understanding of the world and it makes them stronger citizens who are able to challenge things that they otherwise wouldn't have control of. So modern libraries, I think, were invented to democratize access to knowledge, right, kind of in the last 150 years or so. What's the challenge now? So we want to democratize access to making. So I would hope that not in 10 to 15 years, but in 5 years, we will see the equivalent of a library movement for making.
Which is happening.
Right?
Yeah.
And we want that in every town, in every part of the UK.
So I think it's just about time to take questions to the floor.
Thank you very much. Very interesting discussion. My name's Amanda Game. I'm a freelance curator with a long experience of working with makers. And one of the things that working with makers and making materials is it teaches you a kind of awareness of what things are made from. And I would like to ask each of the panel, one of the things the programmes like What's in My Stuff at Sheffield Hallam University have been asking the question of what is the casing in which this technology sits, what material resource does it take, and what is the impact of that on our sort of sustainable planet, because they contain some finite and possibly slightly worrying materials to create.
And this gentleman at the front here.
I'd like to ask a question about morality, in a way, and how these technologies will impact human abilities or how we value human abilities. For example, we value football, kicking a ball now very highly, but maybe 3D spatial skills and things aren't valued that highly by the society in general. So if you could comment on how you think these developments will relate back to our moral position.
Thank you. I run a not-for-profit where in a neighborhood that in the top 5% of deprivation nationally. And we use textile and craft to support people in a whole variety of ways. And we recently had a small contract to work with a group of teenagers to run a sewing workshop as part of an upcycling program about raising their awareness of the global impact. And I'm telling the story because there was a phenomenal moment where we thought we were going to be talking a bit about environmental issues, which I can speak to in a sophisticated way. And we had a huge moment of transition when one of the kids picked up a pretty pearl-headed pin, a stick pin, and asked, "What is this and what do you use it for?" And they literally had never seen one before. I want a view on, you're all talking about using this digital technology to help children or teens understand their world. I actually wonder if there is a dangerous presumption of that they understand some basics around them, and to what extent a better understanding of craft and how things are made is part of that process.
Okay.
Because it's one thing to introduce them to conductive...
An understanding of the physicality of the world around us.
No, it's part of the process is understanding the materials. And actually, as Philip has, I think, very eloquently said, young people need to understand digital media to understand the world. Okay. But are we actually jumping ahead of some of the really fundamentals of what's happening, what is actually physically happening, and what is the role of broader arts and making in making it via these sophisticated mediums?
Thank you. I think I'm going to pose these questions to the board then. So first of all, about casing, who wants to take on that question about these new programs and where that sits in the tech world?
You mean the casing in terms of the casing of the object itself, or the casing of the packaging when you buy the thing and the packaging is in there? Because that is definitely one of a big waste today. So because you buy a thing in the store and it has to travel, and it has to travel safely to yourself, then it is deeply packed into that big load of foam and plastic and cardboard and whatever. And that is a lot of waste. And obviously, if you manufacture your things yourself, you don't need that. So that's a big saving. And then for the casing of the thing itself, obviously 3D printing, I would just say for myself, is a key to that. I mean, that's basically the partnership that we have with BBC for the microbit thing. It's funny because when they came to us first, they came to us just because we are designing things. So they thought, okay, can you help us design the one casing for the micro bit for the schools? And we said, yes, we could, but look, it's going to be a bespoke thing that kids want to do, I don't know, they need to put it on their hat or on their bike or whatever, so the casing need to be different from everyone. So what they need ultimately is not a 1 million units manufactured in China, whatever the design would be, but they need the ability to design their own casing and print their own casing in their school with their printer or whatever. Mm. So I guess on both of these, like packaging and casing, I see more of a bright future rather than something scary.
And I think, you know, one of the other angles on this is the we have low-cost electronics, essentially, and electronics embed all sorts of things in them, and they're being produced at a scale unimaginable previously. And I think we're conscious of that. One of our takes on it is that we want to produce general-purpose technologies that can be reused. So what we don't want is to produce disposable technologies which end up in the bin. And that's why we're committed to supporting our back catalogue of products as well, because we don't want people to stop using them. And I think one of the most exciting things about the maker movement is, you know, in sheds, in makerspaces, people reuse stuff all the time. And actually, to your point, you know, some of the ethos of the maker movement will help aligns with the environmental movement. I think the more we bring that out and the more we create general-purpose technologies that can be reused, desoldered, used again, I think that sends a powerful message about the environmental
movement. And when it comes to...
one thing to that, please, and it is upcycling. One of the categories that we have on My Mini Factory for all those designs that people upload, we have categories. One of those that is the most successful, and I love it, is upcycling. Upcycling is much better than recycling. Upcycling is not you destroy it and then you make something with it. Upcycling is you keep it as it is and just adding something to it, you move it to something useful and new. And people are really creative with that. They turn a pot into a lamp or whatever just by adding 2 bits of plastic on the top, 3 bits of plastic in the bottom, and one thing that should definitely have gone to the bin, possibly recycled, maybe not, would stay forever and become a new thing and has a new life. Mm. And that is one of the most successful categories, which is very, very promising.
And addressing the second question about morality and how these new technologies are changing, or are they changing, how we value human abilities, would you like to weigh in on that, Bethany?
I mean, I think it's a complex question. I think there's... I think there's something about kind of the role that media plays in that and the value that we now put on computer scientists and people that have had deep technical education and expertise that 10, 15 years ago wasn't that way. That wasn't the rock stars of the Silicon Valley were geeks that were doing stuff in their bedrooms. And I think there's definitely a switch happening in what we value as far as skill. I think that there's not a balanced perspective on how that happens, and I think there's a lot of factors to why that is. I do think that there is something that this movement and putting tools into the hands of such diverse people does unlock, which is kind of confidence in more diverse individuals and their abilities to actually do things. The amount of young people that we encounter that don't think they can do things, specifically kind of the gender split that is very evident in the technology world, is not an accident. There's tools that have been designed that are not appealing to diverse groups of people, and the way they're presented are not accessible to diverse groups of people, and therefore there's this constant kind of negative feedback loop in kind of creating this inability to think that certain people can do things. So I think that is shifting. We have a long way to go, but I think it's about getting rid of old baggage to create new opportunities.
And in relation to the last question, does anyone think that there's a danger that we're jumping ahead with these digital technologies?
Yeah, I thought this question was quite interesting. I totally agree. I think we kind of underestimate how much people know about stuff and how things are produced right this minute. We've been looking a lot into the food industry at Provenance, and it's just amazing how few people know about farming and things like that you take for granted. So I do think in a way with the education of creation of stuff, we might be rushing ahead a little bit. But then at the same time, I think, you know, all of the companies here are producing tools that can help young people learn and create new things in a new way and can learn from when they're tiny all the way up, so that the manufacturing process is kind of part of their education rather than something that you just buy into accidentally. There's some great projects, though, coming through that are trying to help educate young people about
how things are really made and the supply chains behind our stuff. One just launched on Kickstarter today from Little Bright Labs.
I know very few people in the digital maker movement who are limited to digital making. Okay, so I would describe myself as a sort of beginner digital maker. I'm nowhere near advanced. But, you know, I try to make furniture and I make cider and I try to do some other things. And what you do when you talk to people at, you know, the Maker Faire in New York and they start a conversation about digital making, they are people who, because they feel a sense of agency and the ability to create, that leads over into all other aspects of their life. So if we're able to give kids particularly a sense of agency and that they can make things, that will lead to them being more curious and feel a greater sense of connection with all sorts of fields of life.
Yeah. Thank you. And I would argue that that split between digital and physical is very much our generation's hang-up and not the young generation's hang-up. Sewing with conductive threads, doing...
I think we have time for one final question. There's a lady there with her hand up.
In relation to farming, this question is to Bethany. I know that you've got customers who are children and parents mainly, but have you actually thought about providing these nature toolkits to small-scale farmers, for example?
To farmers?
Yeah.
Not directly.
Okay.
Where is that coming from? Why do you think that's
relevant? Well, the reason behind that is that obviously it would be quite self-sustaining for farmers, and with technology it wouldn't obviously cost them a lot of money, and it'll be good for them to earn a decent living rather than relying on a large-scale tech. Whereas if you provide small-scale tech which they can benefit with farming and make a living, so I think that there's a bit of a potential there, don't you think?
I mean, our tools in particular are kind of tools that are around things like gaming. We do have thirst plant detectors where you do make moisture sensors, etc. I think things like the Pi absolutely are being used by farmers. They're using them to create irrigation systems. I think we're trying to be really clear, and this I think was brought up in a panel earlier. I think one of the downsides of the maker movement actually is its understanding of its audience, and we've talked about this. And we're trying to be really clear about who our audience is and try and make a dent and really impact a specific group that we think is unloved and unfocused on, that's kind of important. And so, yes, farmers, I think, is really interesting, but I think we're trying really hard as a business to focus on families and young people and try and understand their needs as much as possible to make sure our tools are solving them.
Thank you. I think that that question just about brings us to a close. Could you give a big round of applause to our panellists?
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not download our free app to access video and audio files on the go? Just visit our website, thersa.org, and follow the links to the RSA Vision mobile app.